Welcome to the podcast. Today's episode is the fourth episode in a four-part series on the life and thought of Joseph Ratzinger, Pope Benedict XVI. Our first episode was an overview episode of his life and thought with Dr. Joshua Brumfield. And then the second episode was the episode of Benedict's first encyclical, Deus Caritas Est, with Dr. Andy Starin. The second episode was Benedict's second encyclical, Spe Salve, with Dr. Michael Bollinger. And today's episode is on Benedict's third and final encyclical during his pontificate, Caritas in Veritate. And my guest is Dr. Mark Rugani. Dr. Rugani is an assistant professor of theology at St. Anselm College in New Hampshire. He's published extensively. His most recent article is Capitalizing on Catholic Social Teaching, which he published in Civic Sociology. And he wrote his dissertation on a variety of different topics at the Catholic University of America, but Deus Caritas Est was important for that dissertation, which was called Development as Growth in Virtue at the Catholic University of America. First of all, Dr. Rugani, welcome. Thank you for joining me today.
Thank you, Dr. Squires. It's a pleasure to be here.
So I wanted to talk about Deus Caritas Est, this final encyclical, and then maybe towards the end, put the encyclical in the context of his pontificate, especially in conversation with those previous two that we've already talked about. So as we've done on the previous episode, why don't we just start with the title, Caritas in Veritate. What does that mean, and what is the significance of that title? How is it setting the tone for the rest of the text itself?
Sure. So one of the important things to think about are, you know, charity and truth are both truth as a transcendental, charity as a theological virtue, and really the prime virtue. And this really, I think, is highlighting in many ways the Augustinian roots and focus of so much of Pope Benedict XVI's thought and his theology. And it's also in the opening paragraphs of this encyclical, Benedict XVI does a really good job at kind of laying out the purpose of the title and what he's really trying to do in anchoring a notion of authentic human development in this relational notion of charity, this mutual gift of one person to another that we see reflected in the Trinitarian personhood, but also the way in which we as human beings through the incarnation have been called into that relationship of love and charity. And it's also, you know, good to note that we see that Benedict XVI also kind of pulls a little bit of a wordplay and pun on St. Paul's notion of speaking the truth with charity. You know, what he says is veritas and caritate. And here we get kind of the converse of that, right? We see caritas in veritate. And so really thinking about the notion and the theme of this encyclical as integral human development, what Benedict is doing here is really setting a notion of human development squarely within the notion of the virtue of charity, and really speaking truth to power, in fact, in light of many of the different insights that he gives, and even some of the more critical comments that he makes regarding what he's observed in development projects and programs, specifically many of those, you know, drawn from organizations like the United Nations Development Program. The Millennium Goals had just been set. This is nearing the 10th anniversary of those Millennium Development Goals, and people were starting to analyze and really think about the fruits of whether or not the Millennium Development Goals were achieving their benchmarks, and whether or not those benchmarks were actually what we should have been focusing on. And so I think that that's an important thing for Benedict, is that he's speaking the truth with charity, and he's making the notion and kind of fixating on the idea that authentic human development must be informed and formed by a notion of Christian charity, not just some vague sentiment, not just kind of this, you know, kind of sympathy for others, but that it must be a gift that we give, even in many ways, a gift that might require us to have that kenotic self-emptying experience. And there are some themes that will come up as we will discuss, but particularly a notion of gratuitousness and grace that really should inform what human development and its means to the end look like.
In the introduction of the text, he says, quote, charity is at the heart of the church's social doctrine, unquote. We would certainly assume he would say something like that if he was simply talking about, you know, narrowly the poor, right? How do we help the poor? But the church's social teaching certainly encompasses that, but it's much wider than that. It deals with a whole variety of social issues. So when we think about the social doctrine of the church in that wider lens, maybe it's not quite as obvious what exactly charity has to do with those. So what does he mean when he says that charity is the heart of the church's social doctrine?
Well, I think, first of all, he wants to remind everybody, I think, of a more significant definition of what caritas or charity is. It's more than just, right, kind of giving of our excess or giving to the poor out of gratuitousness. It's a much more deep virtue of one's whole, you know, will to will the good for others. And so I think when we think more specifically, it's not just kind of this kind of supererogatory or, you know, kind of, you know, extra giving that we kind of lend out to the poor, but it's also very tightly tied, as Pope John Paul II, his predecessor, had talked about. Charity is really the form of justice. And I think oftentimes between the secular development world and a more kind of integrated Christian notion or Catholic notion of development, justice can become distended from charity. And so Benedict here, I think, is really trying to call out practitioners of development organizations, to really account for a deeper sense of the spirituality, the higher call of vocation, the vocation to human development, because charity itself is always given. There's a call from the other, and then a call back, and then that kind of mutual reciprocity in this kind of self-giving, hopefully kind of this idea, as I mentioned, imaging of the Trinity, perichoresis, this idea of kind of the cosmic dynamism that we can see. And so it really calls for participation on the part, not just of those who are helping to accompany those in the process of development, but participation, most importantly, by those who are kind of the agents and the clients, the client agents of development, those who are in the process. And really, I think that that's highlights, in fact, the Catholic social teaching principle of subsidiarity, which maybe we can talk about a little bit more later.
He also sets the stage by insisting on a connection between charity and truth, which when we talk about social teaching or even in the secular world, we talk about social work or social justice, those two generally aren't in the conversation together. So again, early on in the text, he wants to make this connection clear. So what do caritas, charity, and truth have to do with each other?
Sure. So when we think about truth, we live in a, what did they say? We kind of live in a post-truth era, which is, I think, false. Even if we kind of practically people will ignore it, there is truth. And speaking the truth about who a human being is, what the human person is constituted by, is important. And so what I think the role of placing charity in conversation with truth at the outset of the encyclical is doing is really inviting people to make a deep consideration of what is the truth of, you know, being human and what authentic human development would look like if we really account for human beings not falsely under a materialistic framework. But thinking about us as embodied spirits and really thinking about the ways in which our development has to nourish and nurture even more primarily our spirit, you know, our spirits, as well as our physical bodies and in our material aspect. It really wants to, I think, bring back together and overcome the kind of a reductivist understanding of what development is.
Benedict sees this encyclical as a tribute to St. Paul VI, 1967 encyclical, Populorum Progressio, which throughout the 20th century, there were quite a few encyclicals on sort of social topics, really a lot of them consciously seeing themselves as an updating or in conversation with the late 19th century Rerum Novarum from Leo the 13th. And I'd like to get into later on what is Benedict adding to that sort of 125-year tradition. But before we get to that, what was Populorum Progressio, and how does Caritas in Veritate sort of take the same themes, but then sort of update them for the 21st century?
So in many ways, this is seen in the same way that you had just mentioned. Social encyclicals really have the modern social encyclical has its origins with Rerum Novarum 1891, Leo the 13th. And there have always been anniversary documents, usually every 20 years or sometimes every, 10 years on the anniversary. So you see them coming in Quadragesimo Anno in 1931. We see, the Pacement Terrace, and we see many of these anniversary ones all the way up through John Paul II's Centesimus Annus in 1991, the 100th anniversary of that document. What this really does is it fits in many ways and recognizes that what Paul VI did in 1967 was inaugurate a more precise kind of series of social encyclicals that really want to focus on this question of human development. And what Paul VI in 1967, we're thinking that this is immediately after the Second Vatican Council. There's this recognition of an increasingly global church, a world church that isn't just kind of located in what we might kind of consider kind of your Western countries or your, kind of European centric. But he starts to, I think, notice that the Catholic Church and Catholics around the world are really thirsting for an understanding of how the global church needs to kind of be a participant in many of the programs that were underway. And this is also not only immediately after Vatican II and this kind of recognition, and I think this new emergence of a sense of a global church, as well as it's at the, really the height of the Cold War, as we see, the so-called First World, so-called Second World, the United States and the USSR and their satellite countries competing in many ways through development in what was called the Third World, in order to kind of gain geopolitical ascendancy and influence. And what Paul VI, I think, is noting is that development is an end in itself. It cannot be instrumental for power and politics. We have to think more carefully about how we treat our brothers and sisters and how additionally, how what we do, those of us who do live in a, quote unquote, developed country or even super developed, as we see in the encyclical, what responsibilities do we have to, those people in situations of development, and what rights do they have? What rights do we have? And really seeing this as a conversation and kind of reciprocal relationship, so that it's not just kind of a one-way directed kind of sense of developing people to one's, to, let's say, the developers' ends and agenda, but really seeing human persons as ends in themselves. And Paul VI really, I think, kind of helps to lay out many of those principles upon which he thinks and the Catholic Church continues to build on what authentic humanism is and authentic human development, what it ought to look like, and what are some limits and cautions as people participate in that process.
So you did a good job there of describing the context of Paul VI just after Vatican II, the Cold War. Caritas in Veritate promulgated in 2009. So again, Benedict is dealing with some of the main themes of all those encyclicals that you had mentioned, but the context is different. Vatican II is, for some younger people, they weren't even born yet. The Cold War is over. How is Benedict thinking about the same themes that Paul VI and others were thinking about, but in this different 21st century context?
Sure. So where we see Populorum Progressio in 1967, reflecting on the question of development, we saw John Paul II make an anniversary document in 1987, as we actually start to, I think, see the waning of this bipolar Cold War world. And so he's looking at it from the perspective of the late 1980s, the kind of the denouement of the Cold War, and maybe anticipating some of those questions. And Benedict XVI is really the first to publish a development encyclical, in a post-Cold War context. So this is something that he's really embarking upon new ground in thinking about the geopolitics, and seeing that there's now a new context for the way in which development happens. Many countries have their own development programs. We have international agencies that participate in those. And so he's speaking to those actors, both state actors, non-state actors. And he's also kind of thinking about the way in which now we see a change in the advent of kind of the rapidification of technology. That's a theme that is brought up in this encyclical explicitly. And it's something that was attended to in the other encyclicals, but he's focusing far more on kind of as we see globalization, digitization, the rapidification of life, and the way in which, you know, as Thomas Friedman said, the world is flat. In some ways, how do we come to grips with the kind of the ways in which these networks of trade, of communications, of material extractions, labor markets, how do we really kind of make sense of it all? In this new kind of less structured, perhaps, international realm. And another theme that comes up that's distinctive from the previous two encyclicals on development, we often think of Laudato Si in 2015 as being kind of the advent of a concern explicitly in the kind of Catholic social encyclical tradition for the environment. But Benedict XVI spends an entire chapter of this encyclical really raising the question about stewardship and really helping, I think, to ground us in the importance of our own role as co-creators with God, stewards of that creation, and really helping us, I think, to account for our role in nature and how that is also reflective of our own human nature when we think about nature as environment.
To your point about the technological advancements that have happened, and even just, you know, in the past 14 years since he promulgated this, of course, so much more when you think about social media. So he talks about this technological development. He says, quote, "Progress of a merely economic and technological kind is insufficient. Development needs above all to be true and integral. What does he mean by that? What does he mean by development needs to be true and integral?
So this is in many ways, right? We're seeing the linking again of this notion of truth to development, as we had talked about, you know, a few minutes earlier, that if development does not have a good portrait of what it means to be human. And as I said, many times development programs are reductivist and think explicitly of human beings as, you know, exclusively material beings. They don't attend enough to the spirit. What Benedict, I think, is really trying to account for is that development projects really focus on important things, right? And these are important. Like, we're providing, you know, food sustainability programs, fresh drinking water, helping to promote kind of construction of housing units, you know, improving opportunities for labor and industry, helping people have participation in their governments, and, you know, kind of creating kind of this natural participation in their civic organization and government. But the one thing that often is left off the table is the moral and spiritual development. And this is, I think, an important thing that comes up in this document is, you know, Benedict warns against it. So-called developed countries in many ways are morally underdeveloped. And this is tied to the notion of superdevelopment, which his predecessor, John Paul II, had included in his encyclical Solicitudo Rei Socialis. But it comes up here again, in many ways calling out the developed countries who who quote unquote got it right and have kind of met their benchmarks, are still in grave need of integral development because they've ignored the moral development and the spiritual development of their peoples. And we see the effects of this with references that he's made to the persistence of a culture of death in our societies, and with the danger, in fact, of underpopulation. There's kind of this looming, boogeyman of overpopulation. And in fact, Benedict XVI addresses what we just saw happen. I was reading about it yesterday, that China's population is now declining. And in fact, will be overtaken by India probably by the end of this decade. And so when we think about the dangers of kind of this materialistic consumerist kind of emphasis in development programs to participate in industry, build profit, they're ignoring the important things like social development of a significant kind that accounts for the spiritual nature of human beings, and really paying attention to the moral requirements that aren't just extrinsic, but the moral development of peoples is something that is tied to their flourishing. If we have the wrong target, we're not going to flourish. We're going to be injured or ill, to use that both, in a literal and a figurative sense. But if we do recognize the true nature of human beings, as I said, as embodied spirits, and attend to the development, not exclusively in a material sense, but really helping people form a moral compass, be responsible to each other in society rather than focused on, selfish interests, profit exclusively. Profit's not bad as long as it is directed to the proper ends. Then we start to really get a notion of what this integral humanism is, this integral human development that, it again, ties the spiritual nature of persons to their material side, not reducing it to exclusively the material side, which leads us down a dangerous road.
And specifically to that point of the moral, let's call it underdevelopment, to put it kindly, of the global north, he talks about the connection between being openness to life and true development. He says, quote, openness to life is at the center of true development. So how is this openness to life a necessary precondition for that moral development, which, as you just said, is needs to be central to any sort of true or integral development?
I appreciate it in this encyclical that as opposed to seeing this as just one among kind of these three encyclicals on development, with Populorum Progressio kind of being the inaugural encyclical and John Paul II's being the second, his being the third, he does refer back to other important encyclicals that are often not attended to in this kind of dealing with the social question, like Humanae Vitae, written by Paul VI the year after Populorum Progressio. And I think what Benedict XVI is doing is, we talked about integral humanism. He's starting to integrate the doctrine of the church as well, in noting that many of these encyclicals that seem to deal with personal morality or with kind of questions of a particular subdivision like medicine or reproduction, or he's starting to note that if we're going to talk about integral development, we have to talk about all these other important sources that we can draw upon that can guide us towards a true portrait of human beings. And so when we think about openness to life, it's a sense in which we are open to being vulnerable, open to contingency. And it really is a kind of anti-modern turn, where we human beings think that they're in complete control or want to be in complete control, and fail to invite others, including the divine persons, right, God, into our lives, and refusing to allow others to impact our sense of security, our sense of stability and power. And so when we're open to life, we're open to the mysteries that it bears with it, many of which can lead us toward experiences of suffering, but as opposed to pushing them away or even eliminating these experiences of true living that can be mixed with suffering that we see with a culture of death and a propensity for a throwaway culture, as we see with the extensive notions of elective abortions, that we see with the rise in legalized medical aid in dying. True development is only going to come when we recognize that as human beings, flourishing does not exclude weakness or vulnerability. Instead, it sees that the way through that is through solidarity, which is a social virtue, and one of those four permanent principles of Catholic social teaching that was articulated in the Compendium of the Social Doctrine of the Church in 2004.
He begins chapter four by talking about the relationship between rights and duties when it comes specifically to integral development. And he says many people today emphasize individual rights. Certainly we as Americans do. And therefore we as individuals have little to no duty towards others. But of course, Benedict critiques that. So what, according to him, should be our understanding of both rights? Yes, but duties as well when it comes to human solidarity.
That's an important distinction, and it's an important thing to think about when we use rights language within Catholic social teaching and the tradition. There's always the corresponding duty that enables a right or a freedom. A good place to kind of go back and to see kind of the genesis of this articulation is in John the 23rd's Pacem in Terris, where you almost kind of see an outlay of the rights that human beings are entitled to, but also seeing that the corresponding duties. And this is something in much of, you know, 20th, 21st century political and legal thought has been seen to be dangerous when you correspond duties to rights, because then it seems that it makes them contingent upon the fulfillment of obligations. But we recognize that if rights are truly kind of enlivening freedoms, liberties that we have, then we need to use them responsibly, and we need to steward them, as I use that term, you know, with regard to nature. We need to steward those rights toward the social good or the common good, another one of those permanent principles of Catholic social teaching. And so you can't have it both ways. You can't, no one can have a duty without a particular power to be able to fulfill it. That's a right. And at the same time, no one can really enjoy a right without understanding how to use it properly, the corresponding duty that follows from it. And that's an error, I think, with so many people. Cervais Pinkers had talked about a distinction between a freedom from, which is often the way that we think, I'm free from, you know, certain obligations, I'm free from responsibilities, I'm free from penalties if I fail to fulfill obligations. And instead, we need to think about rights and freedom as freedom for. How does this enlivening me, empowering me, libertas in an Augustinian sense, to really flourish with others?
You'd mentioned the same thing that I had read of China's population for the first time in, I think, over 60 years, declined last year and is going to be going on that trajectory. The U.S. would be in the exact same situation if it weren't for the fact of immigration, both documented and undocumented. So this question of population is a social issue that is on the front of many people's thoughts, in particular in relation to one of the main issues of the day, which is environmentalism. And many people say, well, if we want to preserve the environment, one of the main things we need to do is have fewer people. Benedict does talk about this idea of population growth specifically within the context of development. So how does Benedict help us understand clearly what should we be thinking about population growth, in particular when we deal with the question of integral development?
Sure. So when we think about population growth, it, first of all, I think it's important to talk about the importance of subsidiarity here, recognizing that those who are most able to judge how to regulate birth are those who are the parents or potential parents in a relationship, spouses. And the Catholic Church affirms that couples have the duty, in fact, to, think about, pray about their vocation to each other and their vocation to parenthood and to regulate birth responsibly. And there are many reasons that the Catholic Church acknowledges why families would choose to regulate birth. And they can be for the physical health of, a couple, one or both parties or existing children. It can be for the spiritual good. It can be for economic reasons even. But the one thing that the Catholic Church continues to uphold is that the way we regulate birth is through natural family planning. Also, once again, recognizing the contingency, the vulnerability, but also the great gift of our embodiedness and the way in which our bodies can communicate to us. And so it's not saying that we need to continue, you know, and to use even Pope Francis's, you know, kind of recent kind of off the cuff, you know, quip that we don't need to, you know, be kind of reproducing like rabbits. But we do have to recognize that it is one of those great gifts and vocations to married couples who are able to respond to their vocation to responsible parenthood. And the way that we do that is through, you know, kind of enabling people through subsidiarity to regulate birth in the Catholic vision through natural family planning. So many of the secular development programs, including the Millennium Development Goals, have been so focused on basically the spread of prophylactics, such as the use of condoms, or promoting the use of chemical contraception, the pill, because of this concern for overpopulation. There's also a question that I always raise is this in some ways inherently potentially racist, right? As it might say that we're trying to stall out the growth of populations in countries that are not yet developed so that the super developed world can continue to enjoy its benefits without having to account for larger populations in those developing areas. And then, so that's always a question or a caution that I invite, you know, my students and my colleagues to think about when we're engaging in these discussions, because it's important to think about that we really need to be on an even playing field when we think about the rights of peoples to regulate birth, to enjoy the fruits of family without being coerced or miseducated on the dangers of overpopulation and in the spread of these illicit methods, according to Catholic doctrine.
In chapter four, he talks about loneliness, and he actually describes it as a poverty, which we generally don't think about loneliness as a poverty. And I actually think Benedict was a bit ahead of the curve on this. I think today in 2023, a lot of people are thinking and talking about loneliness, not just as an individual problem, but as a very serious social problem. And he, like everything else in this text, wants to tie this question of loneliness to human development. So what is that connection? Although individuals certainly suffer from loneliness, what does this have to do socially? What does this loneliness have to do with human development?
When we think about the atomization of the kind of super developed or, you know, even of the modern world, it ties people in and also creates this, I think, false framework of competition among agents. If we think about that economically, we can think about that politically, as opposed to seeing it as cooperative. Competition over cooperation. And that's a false myth that's often kind of shared within other disciplines that don't do the important normative work, as I mentioned, of thinking about to what end are we developing? What is an integral humanism? As opposed to, you know, people claim they stay in their lane and they're just describing the situation. Well, if you're describing a bad situation and you're using that to project into the future, you're going to get some really bad results. And I think we've seen that with, as I said, the atomization of people. We see people who are lonely and don't have strong social relationships turn to other distractions, you know, even the kind of the purveying of, you know, mass and social media, and the way in which that can be a bad salve for a more serious problem. It can also be a useful thing, right? Those are not inherently bad, but if they're misused, they can be distracting. When we think about loneliness, I think back to Robert Putnam's book on social capital, Bowling Alone, that we turn to technology, we turn to distractions. And instead of being with each other and recognizing that great gift that relationships are, and the fact that human personhood is really constituted by relationships, when we're lonely, it's a symptom of, I think, as I mentioned before, a culture of death rather than a promotion of life. It's denying part of who we are. And it can be driven by many things. It can be driven out of fear of rejection. It can be driven out of a fear of, you know, not belonging. It can be driven by anger and tribalism, as we kind of see with an increasingly, I think, polarized country. And so instead, I think a lot of people feel like it's safer to, you know, bunker down. I heard that there was this whole, you know, kind of term that people go goblin mode, right? Where they're just going to kind of stay in your basement, indulge in all your foods and binge watch Netflix to escape. And really all that's doing is it's exacerbating the problem, when maybe what we need to do is to get out, go spend time, reach out to friends, get involved in civic organizations, celebrate liturgy with your religious community. And if you don't have one, there are so many that are inviting and open. And so it's really encouraging people to take that step, because it's one thing to have all of the, as I said, material benefits of development, but if you are lacking in the spiritual, social, and moral development, we're not going to flourish. Instead, we're going to founder.
Maybe my favorite part of the entire encyclical is his critique of corrupt forms of tourism.
Yes.
And how we as a society should reorient our thinking about vacation time. And I think it would not just be, you know, the 2 weeks a year that we get for vacation, but you know, just on our weekends. So what are his criticisms of different forms of tourism? And maybe more broadly, how should we be thinking about our leisure time?
Well, when you use the word leisure, I even think, you know, back to Joseph Pieper's Leisure, the Basis of Culture. And we often, I think, mistake, you know, we mistake leisure for kind of this ideal, like laying on the beach or partying with your friends, as opposed to seeing leisure also as teleologically directed towards, you know, truth, towards the good, towards what is beautiful. Leisure has a contemplative aspect to it that I think the common understanding of leisure time does not. In fact, it's lacking any sort of direction. It's in some ways it's spiritual acedia. And so when we think about how we spend our time, one of the great critiques I think he makes in this section, where he has, I think there are like 9 priorities and proposals that he makes toward the end of the encyclical. When he talks about tourism, we enjoy the benefits, as we said, of a globalized world. And there's much good that can come from engagement with other cultures and peoples through the gift of travel. But when we instrumentalize other people's cultures, other people, as means to the satisfaction of our own hedonistic desires, which you even have, right, tourist destinations that are named hedonism, tongue in cheek, we fail to recognize the purpose, I think, of what this travel, what this gift of encounter can be. And instead, we really dehumanize and depersonalize the very people who live in those places that we have the privilege to enjoy. And that it also makes them even more dependent on the developed world, as opposed to recognizing and celebrating those places and the gifts that they have, their own particular cultures, their own particular industries and gifts and ways of being. And I think that that's one of the things that can contribute. I mentioned Thomas Friedman and The World is Flat. I mean, it can contribute to the McDonaldization of the world. And I don't know anyone who'd want to live in a world like that, where it's uniformity instead of having a appreciation of diversity in universality. Uniformity is not a good kind of universality. To think about Pope Francis's description of a polyhedral world, you know, it's not spherical, because then we lose all the distinctiveness. We lose all of the features that makes every particular person in their dignity unique. What we need to do is to really elevate and appreciate the connectedness that all of our particularities have. And so authentic travel and tourism needs to really be a responsible engagement and an opportunity for, as I said, encounter, because that itself is at the root of what true revelation is. And it's an encounter with Christ. And we can encounter Christ through the faces in a true encounter with others, rather than depersonalizing them as instruments to our own pleasure that we see too often in tourism.
We talked earlier about how Benedict wants to talk about certain themes of development that others in earlier encyclicals had talked about, like Paul VI, and that the historical context had changed by the time we get to 2009. What do we see, though, in this text, not because historical situation or context have changed, but a particular Benedictine element, right? So we've talked about the earlier documents from John Paul II, Paul the Sixth, John the 23rd, Leo the 13th. All right, these are different men. Yes, they're living in different times, but they have different personalities. They have different educational backgrounds. So when you think about this text in particular, among all of the documents that have to do with development, what is the sort of unique Benedictine flavor or taste or personality that's in this text?
I think the highlight here for me has always been this emphasis on grace and gift that we don't see highlighted as prevalently in the earlier development encyclicals. And this comes through in many different ways. It comes through with noting that development itself as a vocation from God is ultimately endowed as a gift from God. Our true development is rooted in this givenness and that we have kind of a prevenient grace, but also the way in which God is operative in and through our lives. And so I think that that's an important element. It also is reflected in challenging some of the prevailing economic theories, as I had mentioned, that might kind of prioritize or kind of even, you know, make normative what are merely descriptive relationships that in fact need to be reformed. So we get this idea of an economy of communion that arises, and that's very much tied to giftedness. And it's not contrary to economics. It is a new and perhaps more challenging vision for an alternative to the competitive, rather than see, you know, instead of seeing it as an opportunity for cooperative work. And then also thinking about, as we just talked about with the tourism, the gift and the grace of encounter that we have through a globalized world, and seeing this, you know, really a unity in diversity. And in many ways, that kind of, I think, brings us back to appreciation of some scriptural imagery about the body of Christ and seeing every element as integral and important, even if it doesn't have the same function, the same resources, the same human capital or technology. All of those are important. And as St. Paul points out, even some of the least, you know, kind of lauded parts of that body are those that are most protected or most cherished. And so I think that that's one of the things that comes up, is this notion of giftedness. And then I also have noted, I think that Benedict the 16th, compared to his other predecessors, really uses well the four permanent principles of Catholic social teaching to say something about the truth of what it means to be human, that we are made in the image and likeness of God with dignity, that we are necessarily in solidarity with each other, that we need to participate in subsidiary relationships and take responsibility for our actions, and that ultimately we work towards the common good, which is the set of all conditions necessary for each and every person to be able to flourish physically, emotionally, and spiritually. So if we think about the giftedness and then the centrality of those four permanent principles of Catholic social teaching, I think that that's really kind of at the core of what's taking place here. There's also been an argument by theologian Gregoire Cotta about Catholic social teaching as theology, that this is a really nice, in many ways, a complement to the Thomistic theology that we might have seen in Solicitudo Rei Socialis by John Paul II. We see here, in some ways, an Augustinian turn with Benedict XVI's encyclical, even the notion, right, the centrality of love, caritas, and seeing always that driven in the great work of St. Augustine, and how Benedict is really, I think, providing an important complement to what had been stated before. And I think that that's a great contribution that's taking place here in this development encyclical tradition.
What would you say is the ultimate or best, most important contribution that this text makes, especially in that line of about 125 years of those encyclicals, from John Paul II back to Leo the 13th, addressing specifically social concerns? What is the ultimate or new unique contribution this text is making in that conversation?
You'll have to give me a moment to think about that, because if I think about uniqueness, one of the things I really appreciate about this text is the way in which it really, I think, is itself a compendium of the wisdom of those other social encyclicals in a recapitulation of those most important elements for a new context, the post-Cold War. This encyclical was originally supposed to come out on the 40th anniversary of of Paul VI, but it was delayed, you know, for a couple of years to be able to kind of see where the global financial crisis was going. So there are some kind of, you know, some important roles it takes with kind of recapitulating all of the important truths from those earlier encyclicals. It's very timely and particular document for our day and age. But really, I think if I'm going to boil down on one, I think that, you know, I mentioned the term encounter, and Benedict in this encyclical continues to talk about development as vocation. And that's an important element, because development so often, I think, is conceived in mechanistic or technocratic terms, that input A, B, C, output, you know, X, Y, Z. And if we think of development that way, we're going to get a sadly insufficient output on the other end. It's going to only mechanize and kind of dehumanize that notion of development. But if we think about vocation, what that is, it's a call, as I mentioned earlier, from one person to another, and a response. It really brings in this notion that development is done in partnerships, in relationships of reciprocity, of justice, and, as we noted, charity, that it's an invitation to be in relationship with others, primarily, right, with God. And if we think about what vocation is and oftentimes how that's related to God, but we also receive vocations or calls from other people, people who are in need. And also sometimes there are those initiative vocations. How can I help you? And people can respond in their need. And when we do that, we really put the human person at the center rather than extractive industries or the rise of financial capital or the instrumentalization of others for one's own geopolitical position. We focus on development as vocation. We do find true charity and truth. So that's what I'm going to say is, I think, the chief contribution here, the titular contribution.
So we just talked about how this text fits in dialogue with the previous social encyclicals. Let's ask a similar question now. How do you see this text in the dialogue in the context of Benedict's own work, either the other two encyclicals during his pontificate, or just his thought in general? How do you see this text in that constellation?
I see this, if we think about in particular, Deus Caritas Est, as being perhaps one of the hallmark encyclicals of the 21st century, and perhaps the entire, you know, if we think about the encyclical tradition, so many wonderful reflections on the most important virtue, God is love. And we can often see in that encyclical an aspect of the contemplative notion of really reflecting on what is charity and how is that reflective in one's relationship with God and in the sustaining of that. This encyclical, I think, puts charity into action. It creates a set of guidelines. If I can put it even more strongly, it kind of gives us marching orders for discipleship, and how we kind of work within our, not just international context, but we have many communities in our own states here in the United States that are in drastic need of development. And, you know, in some ways, right, the material development, but every community is in need of this spiritual and moral development. We need to encounter others. We need to be in deeper relationships. And so when we understand what charity is, as we see Benedict XVI doing that in his 2006 encyclical, right? 2006, is that correct?
Mm, yeah.
And then we see this document come out 6 years later. We see charity in action. And that, I think, is really at the heart of what discipleship is. That's at the heart of my Catholic faith. So I see that as a really important way in which this interfaces with that particular encyclical. And I also, I think I appreciate one thing is that takes place in this encyclical is that oftentimes I think some detractors will try to pull Benedict out of a tradition or kind of, you know, say that he's a stopgap from progressivism or that he's, you know, kind of taking the church back to its roots. I see this as a document that really shows an evolution of his thought and in integration of the themes of his predecessors, of many theologians who have commented on this, not just American theologians, but I think that especially we see in the encyclical tradition, the fruits of a lot of other theologians, European and global, increasingly from the global South. This is one of the documents that started to really include many advisors and theologians helping to write this from the global South, from parts of Latin America, and especially sub-Saharan Africa and Southeast Asia. And so I think that this is a really great hallmark to show how Benedict XVI is in continuity with the tradition and perhaps authentically showing the development of this doctrine into the 21st century. So I think that's what I appreciate, is that we see this tied to Deus Caritas Est, seeing now charity in action. And this, I think, is a wonderful place where we see his thought placed in continuity with the longstanding arc of tradition and doctrine on what it means to be human, on theological anthropology and on the lived experience. And as a moral theologian, I think that I really see that here as well. What does it mean to be a disciple and to do that well?
Final question. We are a people of hope, specifically hope in the resurrection. When you think about our society today and what Benedict is calling for in terms of true integral development, what gives you hope that we can and will take steps towards enacting Benedict's vision?
First, I think that we've seen, he mentions, you know, socially responsible investment. And more people, I think, are starting to vote with their wallets when we think about what it means to be responsible with our money and really thinking about at what cost are we seeking profit or interest. I know that that's something that almost, you know, 15, 20 years ago, this was not, SRI was not something that was really talked about much. It was kind of a niche. And now it's becoming far more mainstream. People are thinking about how is our economy serving us, or are we serving a impersonal economy that only benefits perhaps the 1% or the 0.01%. So that's one thing. I have hope that there's a conscientization of the American people. And I know that this takes place not just in America, but in other places where we're starting to think about how our actions affect others in the economy. This also goes, I think, with the environment. You know, we still are seeing rises, and as I mentioned, Benedict, even prior to Laudato Si, a great encyclical by Pope Francis, but Benedict here spends an entire chapter thinking about that notion of stewardship and the important responsibility as integral human development takes place to nature and to creation. And I think we're making progress. We're starting to see us, you know, instead of looking at perhaps a 5-degree, you know, increase in global temperatures, you know, we might be turning the corner to keep it under 3 degrees Celsius. And we continue to see investment in sustainability, in trying to reduce our carbon footprint. And I think that that's helpful for the future. And then there's always the examples, you know, I don't want to kind of, you can't prove something from anecdotes. But we see, I think, a lot of people who are heroes. We recently saw the death of Paul Farmer, who himself was a wonderful Catholic theologian and thinker about kind of sustainability. And he did his own kind of thought and development. And there are examples like that of people who really have put charity in, you know, in truth into action. And I think that we really need to make those our heroes rather than many of the kind of more popular or kind of savvy cultural heroes, to really lift up those people who are daily living out this vision of what integral human development is. And hopefully that will help us to really live out and to emphasize what I always think is at the heart of the Catholic vision, a consistent ethic of life that really emphasizes not only a right to life, but quality of life for all persons and those who are especially most poor and vulnerable.
Dr. Regani, thank you so much for joining me today. I think this was a great conversation and really a great way to end this four-part series on Benedict XVI. So thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Dr. Suarez. It's been a pleasure.
The harvest is abundant, but the laborers are few. So ask the master of the harvest to send out laborers for his harvest. St. John's Seminary, the seminary of the Archdiocese of Los Angeles, is offering an online MA in pastoral ministry program for lay people. This program will help students improve their knowledge of the Catholic intellectual tradition and improve their ministerial skills for the life of the church. Students will be prepared to work in different areas of ministry and make professional and personal connections with others of the same mind and spirit. This program is for the laity, for directors of religious education, youth ministers, campus ministers, catechists, K-12 theology teachers, and anyone else interested in receiving formation for ministry, such as permanent deacons. You will be grounded in the 2,000-year wisdom of the Catholic Church. Doctrine must always be in service to the people of God, and ministry must always be anchored in the Church's teaching. A grounding in both the doctrinal and the ministerial is essential for any lay minister. The curriculum will be divided into two movements. The first movement exposes students to the depths of the deposit of the faith. You will take courses in the Bible, dogmatic theology, church history, moral theology, and the church's social teaching. The second movement exposes you to ministerial formation for practical application. You will take courses in pastoral ministry, spiritual theology, liturgical theology, and sacramental theology. Having entered into a time when many meetings have gone virtual, including many classrooms, we know that it is important to deliver high-quality content to our students. So we built a studio with professional video, audio, and lighting equipment to produce visually stunning content by our world-class faculty. You'll have a once-a-week Zoom class with a professor in addition to out-of-class required reading and video content. We'll also have an optional on-campus workshop at St. John's Seminary once a semester. This is a great opportunity for us to meet in person to discuss ministerial and spiritual formation, as well as have the privilege of going to Mass and Eucharistic adoration.
For more than 80 years, St. John's Seminary has been educating seminarians with a world-class faculty. Now, this faculty is available for the laity online in the convenience of their own home.
I had always had an interest in the faith, but I was able to explore things like moral theology, church history, scripture on a deeper level than any time before. There's no way you could get this kind of education anywhere than at a seminary.
I have learned so much that I didn't even know existed.
The coursework and the training that I received was immediately put to use doing baptismal preparation classes for couples, marriage prep, canon law, helping out with marriage cases. So I think putting this course online is a brilliant move.
It does allow people who are on the other side of the diocese or the other parts of the state, I'm sure the country even, to have this really rich education.
The formation is absolutely foundational if you want to work in the church, whether in administration or in spiritual direction, if you're a volunteer, if you're a paid staff. Anyone who is working in and around the Roman Catholic Church in North America needs an education like this.
Our online Master of Arts in Pastoral Ministry offers you the chance to continue your education in ministry and designed to provide you with the knowledge, spiritual formation, and practical skills that you need to serve the family of God in our parishes, schools, and other ministries. I hope you will consider the possibility of applying for this program.
Our culture is in a crisis, and the solution to that crisis is the gospel message. By grounding yourself in the intellectual tradition of the Catholic Church, you will be able to go out into this culture and leaven it with the good news.